Welcome to Finding Your Right Mind with me, Vanessa Potter. I think we all know I'm a meditation advocate. I have used these practices for over 8 years and I know what impact they can have on my life. But I'm starting to realise that just knowing that meditation can help you isn't enough. You need to know how and why. And what that really means is you need to understand how your brain works. We actually have an old brain and a new brain. And this is something that scientists have been investigating more and more and more over the years. And these two different brains need to work in tandem. And so today's episode is all about understanding the inner mechanics of our brains. And by that I mean this older brain we've had for millennia, and then this new, more funky problem-solving brain that's much more cognitively driven. But these two systems, when they get out of kilter, out of balance, if one dominates the other, then that's when we get into trouble. And that's how we suffer stress and worry that can lead to illness. So learning about our brains is crucial if you're going to learn to meditate, because otherwise it's a little bit like being given a car and looking at the gears and not really knowing which gear does what or what pedal is the accelerator and which is the clutch. You've got to know the mechanics of your brain in order to navigate a meditation practice. So let me ask, how many of us have got stuck in a thought, stuck reliving an event or a situation, a conversation quite often, and going over and over? And it's often a stressful one, isn't it? It's one that is niggling you and that you just, it's like it's sticky. You can't get it out of your mind. And quite often the emotions attached to that event, whether you are scared or angry or frustrated, that is your threat system. And this is a really crucial system to understand. Our threat system is amazing. It saves your life if you are being chased by a mugger. But let's face it, that doesn't happen very much in life. So we need that system, but what we need to be able to do is to turn it off when we don't need it anymore. So much about meditation is about education. It really isn't just sitting down with your eyes closed. Kirsten McEwan and I talk about how meditation and compassion can live together and some of the enormous misconceptions we have. Really, it is worthwhile. It's not just about making your life smoother, more balanced and easy. It can be about saving your health. We'll also get into how compassion can help relationships and creativity and why compassion is a particularly good meditation to help that. So today we're talking about how tricky our brains are. Compassion meditation is not being selfish. It's not a pity party. It's not feeling sorry for yourself. It's not weak. It is, in fact, one of the strongest, most powerful things you can do. But if we don't understand the configuration of our brains and how much it works against us and how we can change that, then compassion doesn't get a look in. So enjoy today's episode. If you like what you hear, as always, I'd love a review. Drop me a line, ask me a question, and subscribe for more. Hi, Kirsten. It's really brilliant to have you on the show today. Maybe you could introduce yourself and tell us who you are and a little bit about your research area.
Hi, Vanessa. Yeah, my name's Kirsten McEwan, and I'm a researcher at the University of Derby. I've been researching mental health for about 17 years. I'm really interested in how people try and create the conditions for a really good quality of life. So I'm interested in reducing self-criticism and trying to promote self-compassion. So a lot of my research has looked at compassion-focused therapies and how these are effective for different patient groups and for members of the public as well.
An absolutely fascinating area of research and one that I am particularly interested in. I think it would be really helpful, having done a show on kindness and got really into the nitty-gritty of the loving kindness practice, I think we can tease apart what compassion actually is. It's a word we use all the time. And I think sometimes we use it very correctly, but I think there's a lot more to it. So maybe you could just dig into and identify what compassion actually is. And maybe that would help by separating it out from empathy and sympathy and even kindness, just so we really can understand it.
Yeah, it's quite a tricky concept to get hold of, actually. And quite a lot of patients struggle with this concept at first, and their misunderstanding of it can mean that they're a bit resistant to developing it. But really, compassion developed with the mammalian caring system. So it kind of comes from this stimulus response algorithm. So if, for example, if a baby's crying, then the parent goes and soothes the baby. So the stimulus is the baby crying, the response is the parent soothing it. And that's really where compassion emerged from. And it's a two-step process. So the first step is being sensitive to and engaging with another person's distress or your own distress, rather than avoiding it or dissociating from it. And then the second step is to take part in the appropriate action to try and alleviate that distress. And that really requires a bit of wisdom. Because for example, I saw somebody drowning, I would be able to be sensitive to their distress and immediately see that they're in trouble. But then I need to take part in the appropriate actions to alleviate that distress. And if I didn't know how to swim, then jumping in to try and save them would be completely the wrong thing to do. So there are two sets of competencies. There's being able to notice and engage with distress. And then the second step is having the wisdom to know what's the appropriate action to alleviate that distress. And in that respect, it's a bit different to empathy and sympathy, because they're really the first step of compassion. They're that sensitivity to and that response to distress, but they don't involve any action to alleviate it. And then kindness is different as well, because often with kindness, we're giving it to somebody we know and like, and it's all about positive emotion. It's about seeing somebody else experience joy and growth or flourishing because of something kind we've done for them. Whereas compassion always involves an element of distress or suffering. And you can give compassion to people you don't like as well. If we saw somebody that we didn't like and we saw them fall over in the street, we would go and help them up. We'd still be able to be compassionate to them. But we wouldn't normally be able to be kind to them. So we wouldn't pay them a compliment, for example.
Gosh, there's a whole bunch of things there that I'm really interested in. And as you were talking, I was very aware of how nervous these emotions make me feel. And I've done some work on this. And I think this is perhaps one of the problems, that we know we've got all these emotions in us, but we've got this resistance to them. There's this kind of barriers in the way. And like, I think there's often a will, but then there's this fear. Is that right? There's fear associated with these emotions.
Absolutely. And that fear is definitely heightened in people who have issues with self-criticism, depression, anxiety. It can come from different places. It could be that people feel that they don't deserve compassion, that it's not for them. And we often get that in patients. Or it could be that it's such an alien concept for some people that they've just never had those caring, compassionate relationships, that it's frightening to them when they get a taste of it. And also, people are very scared of letting go of their self-criticism. We've had a lot of workshops where we, at the start, ask people, if all your self-criticism could just disappear, you could wake up tomorrow and it's gone, what would be your greatest fear? And there's a big list that comes out of people saying things like, oh, well, if I wasn't self-critical, then my standards would drop and I'd just become this lazy person who never achieved anything. And I wouldn't be able to obtain the perfectionistic standards I'm used to aspiring to. Or I could just become this really selfish person and people wouldn't like me. So there's this worry that as soon as you lose self-criticism, you're just going to become this lazy, terrible person, which really isn't accurate, because there's lots of research to show that if you can increase people's self-compassion, they actually become more conscientious, but just in a healthier way. It's more growth orientated. It's more wanting to learn things for the fun of it and to see your own personal development, rather than that striving to avoid inferiority that you get with performance related striving.
Yes, and I still myself have resistance to this perfectionism element. Was something that came up an enormous amount in my book, and my beliefs around that are really deeply rooted. They're so strong, and even with knowledge and even with work, they're still there, and I constantly have to battle with this need to be doing, the need to be achieving. And it's amazing how I then spread that out to those around me as well, that, you know, you pass it on, and I can see myself doing it. And I do find the compassion practice is great at a circuit breaker. It's definitely a circuit breaker, but I find maintaining it really difficult. So I use it as a constant reining in method. But then I find that those old habits, and it's society as well. And I'm very aware that in my house, you know, I can do this stuff and it makes sense to me. Then I go out in the real world and people, you know, make comments and they ask what you're doing. And also, if you're changing the way you've always been your entire life, that's a model that you subscribe to and that everyone else subscribes to. So to start shifting that is a monumental job because everybody believes you are that way. And so to change it, I think is really difficult. I'm very sympathetic to anybody who endeavors to do this. It is absolutely worth it, but it's not an easy job to do, is it?
No, not at all. And I really agree with your point about society putting this pressure on us to constantly be on the go. It means that we're often in our what we call our drive system, where we're striving to go out and achieve things and gather resources. And then you kind of collapse into exhaustion at the end of it, or into the threat system, and feel like you're not doing well enough. And I think it's even worse at the moment because of social media. It's a whole new audience of people with which you can socially compare yourself and say, am I doing as well as this person? They seem to be having a better time than me. I think it's really unhealthy, the way we live at the moment, with that pressure for perfection.
And ironically, it is even there within the spiritual world. There's quite a lot of, we won't necessarily get into it now, on spiritual narcissism, which is really interesting. I sometimes have this, oh, I'm not being compassionate enough. And I'll listen to some passion tracks and I'll often get to the end and I have to watch out for the voice that's berating myself for not doing this regularly enough. Okay, you're doing it now, but that's not enough. You know? And then you think, you rein yourself in again and go, oh my goodness, this is so deeply entrenched. And then I think actually for me, I have to have a bit of humor here when those moments happen and laugh at myself and laugh at the world, because otherwise I think I would go a little bit crazy. Now, I've mentioned I listen to a compassion track. What I think would be really helpful is if you could just explain, if you were to do a compassion practice, what does that look like? What is a compassion practice?
Well, we start with a lot of psychoeducation with people. So we explain really how tricky our brains are and how they've developed over time to adapt to different environmental challenges, but actually they're really quite a poor design and they come into a lot of problems. So we have this really old part of our brain which is adapted to help us respond to threats and opportunities. So it's the part of our brain that tells us, oh, there's a danger there, there's a threat, maybe it's a snake in the path and we need to pay attention to it and either run away or freeze or do something to prevent being harmed. And this part of our brain can also alert us to opportunities. So it alerts us to go out and gather resources or form relationships with people that can be productive and lead to reproduction and genetic success. But then we also have this new part of our brain that, as far as we're aware, we're the only species to have this, and that's the level of conscious thought that we have. And this is a bit of a blessing and a curse, because it means we've got creativity, we can have fantasy and imagination, but we can also use that to go to quite dark places. So we can ruminate and start replaying old events that we found shameful and start regretting the past. Or we can become anxious and start worrying about the future and what's going to happen in the next few days or the next few years. And as far as we're aware, other species don't do that. And there's a book out there called Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. And the example given is that if a zebra got chased by a lion, it doesn't, after it escapes, it doesn't think to itself, oh my God, can you imagine if I was eaten alive by that lion and how terrible that would be and what would happen to my children? A zebra doesn't have those thoughts, as far as we know. It just goes back to eating. Whereas we can keep the threat going, we can replay it in our mind. So if we have an interaction at work where our boss criticizes us, we can go home and think about that for hours and replay the event. So our brains are very tricky in the sense that we can keep an original threat going for a long time. And that's one of the things that we explain to people when they're doing compassion-focused therapy. And the other thing is that we've got these three systems. We've got a threat system that helps keep us safe and alerts us to danger. But we've also got this drive system that helps us to become motivated to go after resources. And often, I think society encourages us to bounce between those two systems. So if we're feeling threatened, we often try and calm our threat system through drive. So we start distracting ourselves and trying to achieve more things. And actually, there's this third system, which is really, really linked to mammalian caregiving, called the soothing system. And that's where we want to be spending a lot of our time. And that's all to do with rest and digest. It's our recuperation system, and it's about feeling connected to other people, connected to ourselves, and just calm and soothed and content. So we explain to people that this is the system we're going to try and focus on. And a bit like physiotherapy for the brain, we're going to try and strengthen up this muscle. We're going to try and stimulate those feelings of soothing. And the primary way that we do that really is through compassionate mental imagery. So we know we've got these fantastic imaginations. We can fantasize about holidays in the future and what a romantic relationship might turn out to be like. Given that we know this, one of the ways that we can stimulate compassion in our brains and in our bodies is by merely imagining another person being really compassionate and caring towards us. And that will have the same effect on our bodies as if the real person were there. It's really powerful. So a very simple exercise would be to imagine your ideal carer, your ideal nurturer. And for a lot of our patients, that can be quite difficult. They've not had many experiences of people being kind to them. So often their images are of animals or nature being accepting and kind and having wisdom, non-judgment, and completely accepting them for who they are. And when we're doing this imagery, we really get people to visualize what that might look like. If they can imagine a person or an animal, what would their facial expression look like? What would their tone of voice be? What would their body posture be like? We really try and get them into the moment and imagining what it's like to receive compassion from another person.
That's so powerful. When you were talking, I'm just thinking the whole time how we're fooling our own brain, aren't we? We're making it work to its own advantage, which is to take your own imagination. And because of the way our brains are set up, we can picture that person. And I know I've done this firsthand. If you go into that image, go into that feeling and the smells and evoke all of your senses. And particularly, I found if I imagine a particular scenario, something maybe that's even happened, and I put that person in it, you get this flood of emotion, which is really powerful and real because your brain doesn't know that that's not happening. And I just think it's this brilliant mechanism where we can catch ourselves out, where we can fool ourselves, but fooling ourselves in the good way rather than the way that we fool ourselves 90% of the time in a negative way. So I think there's something really lovely about that. And again, I'm smiling because I can feel some humor that we have to learn about ourselves. We have to forgive ourselves for being human, for thinking and for getting wrapped up. And we also have to think about society, just going back to that, and social media. It's designed to capture our attention. It's designed to make us compete. It is designed to trigger neurochemicals that make us want more of it. I did an interview all about this, about social media and the way that it hooks in children in particular. And it was very interesting that we talked a lot about being compassionate about ourselves during that process, because you're fighting an uphill battle there, because scientists and developers and researchers, it's research informed. We know psychologically how we work and what we look for. And a lot of social media is absolutely designed to capitalize on that. So I think we have to stand back a little bit and not beat ourselves up for getting sucked in the first place. But then also this idea you talked about educating yourself on now, what's the implication of that? How does that lead to your thoughts? How does that lead to your feelings? And what does that make you do and behave? I really like this idea of educating. For me, that's been one of the most fundamental parts of even buying into a compassion practice, which kind of brings me to this idea that I know if I've mentioned kindness practices or compassion practices, I get a lot of eye rolling. It seemed as a little bit inconsequential. There doesn't seem to be much payoff. I think you described it as low ranking. Can you talk a little bit more about why do we see that? Because it's crazy.
Yeah, this really comes from a misconception about compassion. People think that it's a low position in the human hierarchy, that if you have compassion, you're somehow inferior to others, that it's a weakness, or that it's associated with pity or letting yourself off the hook. And I've heard many people say, oh, I don't want to have a pity party. that really does come from a misconception of compassion, that it's a weakness, but it takes an enormous amount of courage to have compassion, because you're engaging with distress, whether it's somebody else's or your own. You're engaging with it rather than avoiding it or dissociating from it. And you're taking part in an action to alleviate it. And that really does take courage. I mean, if you think about firefighters, that's a compassionate act. They don't know the people in the burning building. They're not running in to save them for any other reason than they see somebody in distress and have to perform. They know it's their job to perform that appropriate action and to go in and alleviate that distress. And that takes a lot of courage. But I think this is why it's devalued. And one of the things we found with our research is that really competitive people and narcissists really devalue compassion. And they're the ones who see it as this weak, fluffy thing that's self-indulgent.
That's fascinating. And I'm interested, is there a divide between the sexes as well? Because I'm interested in that, because my gut tells me that perhaps women are more wired towards this. Is that perhaps because of the nurturing side? I don't know the answer to this, so I'm curious. And my instinct is that if I talk to men about this, they get instantly very uncomfortable. It's not seen as a male emotion. It's not seen as their job. And very much a weak practice.
Absolutely. That's a really accurate instinct. We've had to work a lot to adapt the compassion model for men so that they're more accepting of it. And a good example is, I have a colleague who works in the American prison system. And when he first tried to do compassion work with the prisoners, they just laughed it off and said, "Do you know how tough I've had to be to survive in this environment? I can't be showing emotion. I can't get into all that soft stuff." So he really had to reframe it for them as courage and as being a strong male role model, this protective figure who sees distress in others and is motivated and has the wisdom to go and alleviate that distress.
I love that you have the two words together, courage and compassion. And I think compassion really needs a lot of rebranding. I think from those that know about it, there's this big gap where a lot of people fall down between, with their misconceptions lead the way. And actually at the front, you almost need to have courage before compassion, because you have to be to go there. One good side about social media is that, you know, men are getting more of a voice, mental health, people with anxiety feel at least they can voice it. And I think that's stepping in that direction of compassion, certainly. But I love the idea of it being associated with the word courage. And also, I'm going to pick up on the word friendship. Now, we talked about this before. Kristen Neff has done a huge amount of work in fact, she coined the phrase, didn't she, self-compassion in her research work. I'll put some notes about her in the show notes. And perhaps you can flesh it out a bit more, but she talks about being a friend to yourself. And I love this concept. Perhaps you can explain it better than me.
Yeah, this is a really clever and simple concept where if you're struggling to be compassionate to yourself, because our kind of routine is to usually be self-critical when something goes wrong and start calling ourselves names. But if you're really struggling to be self-compassionate, then an excellent way to get into this is to just imagine for a moment, if a friend were going through the same thing as you, what would you say to them? How would you treat them? What would your whole manner be towards them? And usually people are able to imagine this really easily. And then you can suggest that, well, can you direct that to yourself? Can you give that to yourself? So it can be a really good way to facilitate people who are a bit resistant to self-compassion, to helping them to experience it and know what that should look like.
I found that instantly relatable. I'm taking away the focus from myself, you know, so we're always much more comfortable with that. It appealed to me because I felt I could be useful. I was being helpful. And that put a different slant on it. So I kind of got this whole angle of being a friend to yourself, because it somehow takes away it feeling too close to me. It was one step away, if that makes sense. It was a really clever concept, like you say. And I think that's one that perhaps men would relate to, because most people like to be seen as loyal, trusting, friendly, caring. And if you think all those attributes are instantly there with friendship, particularly close friendship, so you've got those emotions first, and then you say, well, just apply that to yourself. It's easier to do it through the friendship model than it is just by going and doing that to yourself. Because I do think that other voice jumps in very quickly with you're being selfish, you're indulging yourself. And actually, I quite like to talk about our little inner critics, our inner voices. I have become on first name terms with mine over my meditation experiment. And Sharon Salzberg, I think, does some great work around this. And in one of her books, she suggested naming it. And I was like, wow, oh my God, that totally appeals to me. Mine instantly had a name. She's a she, and she's called Cruella de Vil. And she has a fur stole and she flicks it and she has a cigarette holder. And she's awful, actually. But I found with the inner critic that sometimes the voice is very front and center and it's very loud. But the more practicing that I did with the different meditations, the more I realized that there were voices much deeper down, and I describe them as whispering. And I think they can be very insidious. And actually, I think they can be very hard to identify. So perhaps you could just talk a little bit about your patients and inner critics and how you deal with that.
Yeah, it's pretty hard to really erode away that self-critic because it is so automatic. We all do it. And there are two different forms of self-criticism that we engage in as well. There's the much more common version that most people will be familiar with is a sense of feeling inadequate. And this type of self-criticism has a self-correcting function. So we might be driving somewhere and lose our way and be late for a meeting. And we might start to say, oh gosh, you're such a fool. You never look at the maps and you need to do more preparation for these kind of things. And you've got to do better next time. And there's always a sense of feeling inadequate, but it's about self-correcting and trying to improve upon the performance for the next time. And then we've got this much more self-hating, self-persecuting style of self-criticism, which is really about destroying parts of the self. And that's where you might start swearing at yourself, calling yourself horrible names, telling yourself that you're useless at everything. And they have two different functions. And it's the self-correcting one that people really find difficult to let go of because they believe it's helpful. They think it's the type of self-criticism that keeps them on their toes, that keeps them ahead of the competition, keeps their standards up. And so it's really pervasive and hard to let go of that self-correcting form of self-criticism.
How can we do that? What is there something that we can do to just start softening the voice maybe?
I think it comes partly from mindfulness, from a mindful awareness of actually noticing when you're doing it, because for so many people it's utterly automatic. I've seen a lot of clients go through the compassion therapy who say, I'm not a self-critic, I don't do that. But when you actually get them to connect with their critical voice, like you've said, to imagine their Cruella de Vil and to imagine it in detail, what does she look like? What's her posture like? What does she say to you when things go wrong? Then they go, oh, I do have a critic. And for people who are more in the sort of harsh self-critic zone, theirs can look like this horrible monster or this black mess in their head. Whereas for people who are more in the inadequate self-criticism style, it could be more like the demon headmaster from the children's television program or something. But once they realize it's there, I think it makes a big difference. And once you contrast that as well with compassion, if you get people to imagine that critical self and say, okay, you've just imagined your critical self, how do you feel now? How do you feel in terms of being able to address that failure that you experienced and move on from it? You go, well, I feel knackered. I'm exhausted. I don't have any motivation. I just feel like I'm on the floor. And for people who've got the really persecuting style, they just say, I feel like utter rubbish. I can't get up. There's no point. There's no point to me even trying. When they try and go into their compassionate self and you take them through the same imagery experience, you know, imagining what it looks like, the voice tone, they come out of it and you say, okay, how do you feel now about this problem? And the contrast is amazing. And people really say, wow, I feel motivated. I've actually got energy and I kind of feel like I could move on and solve this problem. They just feel a lot more able to deal with issues if you come at it from a compassionate rather than a critical stance. So I think having that awareness, doing those kind of mindfulness exercises, and even if it's hours after the event, even if it's several hours later and you've been replaying it, if you can just catch yourself and say, oh, I'm doing that thing, that's my self-critic, let's try and reframe this and spend some time with self-compassion and see how I feel differently.
That's really helpful. And I'm just aware of a wonderful phrase that gets used in mindfulness. I haven't heard it so much recently, but the thought train, you know, realizing that thoughts are kind of like trains, and sometimes they are high-speed bullets and they're off so fast that you can't see the landscape passing. But actually being able to jump off that thought train and just stand. And I think also the idea of the critic, you don't necessarily get rid of your critic, do you? And I'm quite aware that for me, sometimes I had to almost change my relationship to my critic. So my critic was still there. Cruella was still around. But it helped me to have a bit of concern, a bit of empathy and a bit of curiosity about Cruella. Why is she being like that? You know, you're really a horrible person. And you flick around and you put on this act, and I can see that act. You know, what's behind that? I mean, maybe it's a bit strange to still, you know, doing some weird psychology job on your own self-critic, but it was really helpful because it stops the thought, it stops the nastiness, and it gives you a pause button. It also allows you, because of course, at the same time, you're being kind to yourself because you're allowing yourself that space between you and some event that's and your reaction to that. You're just creating air between all of it where you can, like you say, perhaps reassess. And then I think that's where the rational mind, rather than this emotional mind constantly driving us, the irrational mind gets a look in and then can be reasonable. And I just find what happens with Cruella, she just kind of disappears. She kind of fades again. So she comes forward and backwards in my mind. But having a relationship, and as you say, noticing, I think, is absolutely crucial to that, because otherwise you're driven by these thoughts and these critics without sometimes even realizing. And I think that must happen a huge amount. So we really got into the nitty-gritty of inner critics and compassion. What I think would be really helpful is to talk about the benefits. We know that this is quite hard to do, quite hard work, but there are really good reasons for doing it. One of them is improving relationships. Maybe you could talk about how compassion in your life and towards yourself could improve your relationships.
Well, I think the more you're able to self-regulate through compassion, the more you're able to tone down that threat system and those critical voices, the better your relationships become, because you kind of get out of that threat or competitive mode of thinking and social comparison, comparing yourself with others. If you step out of your threat system and into your compassion system, you're much better able to engage in more collaborative and supportive relationships. And we've even seen this with patients who've undergone compassion-focused therapy, that at the start of therapy, people who they thought were good for them, who they thought they had a supportive relationship with, once they begin to learn about real compassion and what that looks like, quite a few of them realise, oh, these relationships aren't that supportive. They're not that good for me. And at the end of therapy, they've kind of put some distance between themselves and those relationships and said, no, this is not the compassionate choice for me to be friends with these people. I'm going to seek out more nurturing relationships with others. And I think just having that compassionate mind frame and being in that sort of caring system allows you to really appreciate the people that you're with. Be more tolerant and patient when they are struggling or when they are showing signs of distress. So I think all around it just encourages better quality relationships.
I totally agree. And I'm also curious, because I found my creativity peaked a lot during certain practices. And I found there was definitely links between being compassionate and, I suppose, open perhaps, and creativity. Could you talk a little bit about how this can spark creative thinking?
Yeah, well, if we're in our threat system, we're pretty much going to be rubbish at everything, because threat really narrows our attention. Our attention becomes completely soaked up in the threat itself, how to deal with it. We've got to keep monitoring it, making sure that we stay safe. And if your attention is narrowed like that, you really can't engage in creative thinking or be open to new experiences. And so being able to move from your threat system into a more soothing, caring, compassionate system, it opens up your attention again, and you're much more likely to be able to think up creative solutions. And an example of this is an exercise that we do where we get people in pairs and we get them to talk to each other about a problem they're having. And for the first 2 minutes, one of the pairs will just talk freely about this problem that they're having, and the other person listens. And then for the next 2 minutes, they imagine, what if I was at my absolute compassionate best? I had all these qualities of wisdom, non-judgment, acceptance. And they talk about the problem again, and the person listening to them is shocked, because it's like looking at a different person. And they usually feed back afterwards and say, wow, you came up with loads of practical solutions to that problem in that second compassion session. And you would seem so much more calm and accepting and realistic about what could be done. So I think it really does open up a lot more creativity and possibilities. And some of Kristen Neff's research has shown this as well in terms of academic achievements, that if you are able to train students in compassion, they move to this more growth focused style of learning where it's all about personal development, and they actually achieve better results academically than they weren't to do that training, and they were more driven by trying to strive to avoid inferiority in comparison with other people.
I wish there would be more of this in our education. And in fact, you know, even with parents, when children come home and the push with homework and achieving scores and grades, passing exams and keeping up, it is an enormous pressure. I can totally see how compassion can be a brilliant antidote to that, but more than just an antidote, like you're saying, an actual benefit, and can open you up. Because, and I find this all the time, when I come into that much more nurturing state, which is often when I walk, I go outside, I do kind of walking meditations, but I do the meditations at home as well. But particularly the ones where I go outside, I just get this flood. In fact, it's sometimes overwhelming. And it's like my brain has stored up all of its great ideas, all of its intuitions, all its insights, all of its book ideas, and oh my goodness. And it comes flooding out when I'm in this state. In fact, I now have to go into my phone and like just say all these things down so I capture it so that my brain can then calm down. But it's amazing how it opens a floodgate of creativity going into that state. And I suppose also because I'm conditioned a little bit, so I've got the habit now. So it's almost like my brain waits. It's like, oh, we're going for a walk. Now what I'm going to do is flood you with ideas. And they're not crazy things. It's great ideas. You know, I think there's definitely something in there that I wish we could sort of capture and bring into education, you know, teaching children outside, all of these things I think would be great. Anyway, we're onto a slightly different topic there, but I know that you're a supporter of forest bathing and nature. And in fact, actually, I'm quite interested. You've done some work recently, haven't you, with nature and forest bathing and compassion and seeing how people's state of mind changes when they're in those environments.
I thought that a lot of the theory behind compassion, it's really evolutionary theory, and a lot of the examples used in the psychoeducation come from animals, like the zebra example. And both compassion-focused therapy and forest bathing, what they're trying to target is getting you into that soothing system. So I thought the two would really complement each other. So last year we had a go at combining compassionate mind training with forest bathing, and had pretty good results. People definitely seem to get into their soothing system, and we could see that not just from their questionnaire responses, but also we measured their heart rate variability, which is an indicator of how much you're in your threat, drive, or soothing system. And a lot of people's heart rate variability increased, showing that they were more in that soothing system. So I think being outdoors and doing any kind of therapy really is quite complementary, because, you know, we've spent most of our history as a species in the outdoors. It's only relatively recently that we've become urbanized, so we're really adapted to respond to natural stimuli, and there's quite a few studies showing our attention is better when we're outdoors. So I'm not surprised that you're experiencing all these creative ideas as soon as you step outside and get into nature.
And I find as well it's a cyclical thing. It becomes sort of mildly addictive in a really nice way, because of course all the positive, you know, neurochemicals that get released, and so of course that makes me want to do it even more. And I think it's really good to just say that, you know, meditation doesn't necessarily, and doing a compassion practice doesn't have to be hard work. I mean, it can be challenging because of the emotions you have to deal with perhaps, but You don't have to sit, beat yourself up, the critic again, you must sit on your sofa, you must do this for 20 minutes. I think we're a bit hard on ourselves, even when it comes to the meditation. And actually, it's totally legitimate to do practices outside and to incorporate it into if you're already going for a daily walk. I think it's also worth mentioning, because I didn't know what forest bathing was when I first heard this term. It's not lying down necessarily in the middle of a wood, which is what I instantly had this picture of a person lying kind of spread eagled in a forest. And whilst, of course, you know, connecting with nature and the ground, there's lots and lots, you know, of good stuff from that. It's more about walking in nature and slowly observing and being mindful of your environment and allowing your senses to absorb it rather than actually lying down. I'm interested in other research as well, because there's been some quite interesting compassion studies. Is there anything that you found particularly fascinating in your work?
Yeah, I think really it's moving away from questionnaire measures with people and measuring the way their body reacts to compassion. Because I think a lot of us, if we're honest, we don't have that great an insight into how we're feeling at any given time. Because it's not like we ever experience just one emotion in isolation. It's usually a combination of different things. And it's how tuned in a person is to that as to how able they are to say how anxious they're feeling in a given moment. So questionnaires are helpful, but they're maybe a bit limited by people's insight. And what I've been really enjoying is measuring people's physiological responses to compassion. The most common way I do this is by looking at heart rate variability, because that's an indicator of what we call our parasympathetic nervous system, or in other words, our rest and digest or soothing system. And I recently did a study with bipolar patients, and bipolar patients are a classic example of people who bounce between their threat system and their drive system. And that's where you get the lows of depression and the highs of mania. They're just bouncing between those two systems, and really their soothing system is so undernourished and underactive. So the compassion focused therapy was aiming to get that soothing system really online in patients with bipolar disorder, and to move them away from their threat competitive system and more into their collaborative, affiliative, caring system. And we were able to show this through heart rate variability. We got bipolar patients at the start and the end of the study to really imagine a scenario where they felt really competitive and they felt like they'd lost out on this competition. Maybe it was a job interview or something that they failed at. And then we also got them to imagine a scenario where they felt really connected to other people and like socially they were doing really great. And we compared their heart rate variability while they imagined these two scenarios at the start and the end of the therapy. And at the start of the therapy, you could see a huge shift in heart rate when it came to the competitive scenario. People's heart rate went right up and their heart rate variability, so their soothing system, crashed. It went right down, showing that they'd really gone into that drive threat system. And when we tried to do the compassionate imagery with them, they didn't really have much of a response. But at the end of 12 weeks of therapy, the pattern had completely shifted. So there, when they did the competitive imagery, not much response this time, but when they did the compassionate imagery, huge increase in heart rate variability. And for some of those patients, they'd had what we call a clinically at-risk profile of heart rate variability at the start of the study, where you're at risk of cardiovascular disease. And in a couple of them, that had completely shifted and they were showing a healthy profile. So that's really exciting to see in reality how a person's body changes in response to, you know, several weeks of compassion-focused therapy and the real impact it
has. That's extraordinary. And you're right, the physiological measures are real and, you know, they're measurable, aren't they? I think we're becoming much more somatically aware and really paying attention to the emotional responses in the body, rather than always, you know, rationally trying to figure stuff out. I'm thinking of Peter Levine's work, which I'm sure you've come across, his trauma work with the trauma cycle. And I'm remembering what you said about the zebra, because of course, when a zebra's attacked, they don't go off to their zebra mates and go, oh, blimey. They do the shaking thing, don't they? They complete the trauma, the stress cycle, and their whole body's, you know, just, you see them do it, and dogs do it, and all animals do it.
Yeah.
They shake and they and then they snort a bit, and then they look around, they're still alert, and then they gradually come down, and then they start eating grass again. And of course, as humans, we don't allow ourselves to go through those whole cycles, allowing that physical, that somatic manifestation of that alert, that driving, that dangerous moment. So that's great that research is kind of being much more conscious of that as well.
Yeah, and what's happening in the body. I think that's a fascinating point that you make as well, because that really does show one of the conflicts between our old and new brain, is that animals are so much in their old brain. There is so much in either their threat system or their kind of seeking out opportunities system, that they're much more in touch with their immediate needs. Whereas I think we've got this conscious new brain that can make us override or ignore our immediate needs. And yes, if we're feeling threatened, we probably should do what the zebra does, leap around, snort, go for a run. But we often don't. And I do, when you were telling me about that, I was remembering one of those TV programs about tribes. And whilst they were filming, they came across a snake in the path, and the snake slithered off. But the tribe started kind of leaping about the path, jumping back and forwards, and they said it was a ritual to get rid of the fear of the snake and to move on from the incident. And I just thought how similar that seemed to the strategy that other animals adopt when they encounter a threat, and how you see them sometimes collapse onto their side and just running on the spot, on the floor, just to get rid of that adrenaline.
We so miss a trick. We think we're so clever and intellectual. You know, when a child has an accident, we pick them up, don't we? They start shaking. We're like, there, that's okay. We try and suppress the bodily response, and we suppress it. And also we kind of do this looking around, we're embarrassed. So there's this shame attached to it. And all of this silly, silly societal nonsense, all these stories that we've told ourselves about how we need to respond to things. My son had an injury last year, quite a bad one on his knee. And we're only becoming kind of trauma literate. I think now it feels like every day I seem to learn a little bit more about it. And even then, looking back, I can realize that, you know, he was shaking. We were shocked. And everybody was trying to mask it. We all hide those emotions. And we say, it'll be okay. Whereas actually it should be more, we're here. You're going through this. You're going to shake. That's normal. That's expected. It's your body's response, but we're here with you. And that's the compassion, isn't it? We're alongside you. We're not going to try and deviate from this cycle of emotion. We're not going to stop it because it needs to process. But of course, society, you know, we didn't do that. We went, there, it'll be fine. No, you don't need to shake. You don't need to cry. It's like, we're kind of our own worst enemy.
Yeah, very much
and
so.
Especially when we get into the somatic side, I get very excited about that. But perhaps you could bring us back to reality. Have you got in your compassion toolbox a little practice that we could do? If people have been listening to this going, a lot of this chimes, a lot of this makes sense to me, I want to walk away and do something today. Have you got something you could share for us?
Yeah, I think probably one of the most simple exercises that people might be able to incorporate into their daily practice would be, when you experience some kind of threat, you're going to go into your self-critic. But when you're there, as soon as you're able to break that thought process and go, oh, here's my self-critic, just take a moment to think, what would be the compassionate thing to do right now for myself? And you might want to use some of the imagery. Just imagine if I was at my compassionate best, if I had wisdom and courage and non-judgment, what would be the best compassionate thing to do for myself right now? And just asking that question, I think, will help lead into more compassionate thinking and away from that self-criticism. Even if it's hours after the event, it's still
helpful. That brings in that curiosity again. You know, when you start questioning, curiosity comes alongside that. And I think that's a really helpful framework. It's a helpful place to have yourself in. I'm open now. I'm open to suggestion. Because I think if we try and take away, not even take away critics, but suppress them, I don't think that helps, because that for me never worked. I had to just allow, but then be curious and be kind. And it's amazing how it makes it fade. It does work.
Yeah, and it gets better over time. I mean, these are life skills. They need daily practice, really. But if you keep practicing, it does get easier, and that critical voice will become a bit more quiet.
Made a very good point. It's training. And I think it really helps to see this. You know, we're trained for a 5 or a 10K run. We go and exercise our body and our body gets better at it. You know, we go to the swimming pool, we get faster, we can do 10 lengths and then 20 lengths. And it's exactly the same with compassion training. I think it really helps to see it like that. Rather than just a random thing that you do every so often, there is actually purpose and motive and outcomes that come from a compassion practice.
Yeah, and you wouldn't just use it in a crisis. That's a bit like trying to learn how to row a boat in stormy waters. If you practice every day, you're really preparing your mind and changing it and preparing it for more compassion and helping you get out of your threat system a bit quicker. It's not that we're trying to get rid of the threat system at all, because it's helpful to us. It's what's kept us alive and safe all of our lives. It's just about being able to move out of it quicker so we don't keep that threat going for longer than is necessary, and just move back into the soothing system and give ourselves a break
from being us. Sometimes when people say, why do you meditate, it's like, I need a break from being me. And actually, yeah, I'm going to stick with that because, well, I know what it means. It's been absolutely fantastic talking to you today, Kirsten. That's been just so much information and so helpful, and thank you for sharing that little practice. I think that's totally doable. I've really enjoyed talking to you.
Yeah, me too. You're welcome.
Fantastic. Thank you.